This is Ham College, episode 114, for June 14th, 2024. Ham College is brought to you by ICOM. Keep your contesting edge and be a field day leader with ICOM. Field Day is one of amateur radio's favorite events and is just around the corner. On June 22nd and 23rd, more than 40,000 North American hams will come together to operate remotely. Hi, welcome to another episode of Ham College. I'm Professor Thomas.
And I'm Dean Martin.
And tonight, we've got a treat for you.
Yeah?
This class is, well, I guess it's aimed at everybody, but we're circling back around. We finished the amateur extra exam in the last episode. We got to the very last section of questions, went through them, so y'all need to take your test. You have, what is it, like 14? You got 16 days to go take your extra exam.
Better hurry.
Better hurry, or else you'll have to study the next question pool, which is pretty much going to be like the old question pool. A few things changed.
Yeah.
So tonight, what are we going to do?
We're going to start over at square one with the technician question pool.
We are. And we started Ham College 10 years ago with a technician exam. We're aiming this at people who'd like to become hams. Or maybe if you were a ham, let your license expire. Just go take your exam again if it's past the grace period. Get relicensed. Maybe you got friends or family members that would like to become amateur radio operators, or you want to twist their arm and hope they'll become amateur radio operators.
Yeah. I've been twisting my son's arm for years, and he still hadn't given in.
Mine finally did. After I quit twisting, he got his ticket. Now, he's not really active, but he could be.
But he could be if he wanted to.
Yeah.
I bet you if he still lives down there, down south, right?
Yeah, in Houston.
So catch a good hurricane down there, I bet you he'll be looking to turn it on.
Yep. As a matter of fact, he brought me back an antenna
that
I had given him. And we might use it at field day, which is next weekend.
Wow. Seems like it was just last year when we had it.
It does seem like that, doesn't it? Well,
looking forward to it. It's always a good time.
It is. Now, we're shooting this episode sort of out of sequence. Normally, in the middle of the month, we're shooting Amateur Logic. This month, we're shooting Ham College, and Amateur Logic will be at the end of the month on June the 28th. That'll be a weekend after field day. So that gives us an opportunity to go ahead and present our field day content earlier rather than hold it for a month.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, seems like it would be.
Yeah, this also starting back over with the technician pool is good because, I mean, we're here doing this, trying to make new hams and get people to upgrade to general and extra. So those, like you said, we started 10 years ago with the technician pool. And if somebody's looking for study material, there's 10-year-old stuff is probably going to seem, even though it's really still pretty relevant for the most part, it's going to probably seem a little out of date to people that don't know any better.
Yeah. And as I mentioned earlier, some of this has changed a little bit. So if you memorized all the questions and answers from last time, if you memorized the letters that went with each question,
every single one of them, all 300 or whatever there are.
Yep. They're going to be, some of them going to be different.
Oh, man. I got to rememorize them all again.
If you're going to take it again, which I don't know why you would, you've already passed it.
Well, I take a small portion of it every month anyway. So.
Well, I do too. And it's good to go over some of this. One or two of them kind of, I don't want to say trip me up, but they kind of did.
Yeah, it happens. You know, like I said before, it's always good to have a refresher, no matter how long you've been a ham, how much you operate. Some things just don't stick with you. So, you know, going over the material again is not a bad thing for anyone.
So there's three different classes of amateur radio licenses. There's a technician exam, which is the entry level. Then there's the general exam, which adds more privileges. And then there's the extra exam, which adds even more privileges, and that's the...
Pretty much all of them.
All of them. And that's the top license. But you always start out at the technician. The elements build on each other till they get progressively harder. Technician is really more about learning how to operate and learning some of the rules that you need to observe. Mm-hmm. You don't get as many frequency privileges, but... you get enough.
You get enough that I had it for over 10 years.
Oh, that's me too.
All I had, and I was,
yeah,
had a great time with it.
Really didn't know any better, did you?
No.
Well, we knew that there was other stuff out there, but until they dropped the Morse code, we're slackers. We didn't actually learn the code. We upgraded to extra just as soon as they dropped the code.
Yeah. I figured I write enough code every day. I don't want to learn any extra.
Me too. Anyway, you're stuck with us now. A couple of no code extras, I guess you could say. Why would you want to get into amateur radio? You know, I see people every now and then, and they say, well, what's that on your car there? Is that a CB antenna?
Oh.
I said, no. And they said, well, my uncle has a CB. But,
yeah. It's not quite the same thing. It's similar technology, but it's a different thing. CB, you can do, and people do, pretty much anything they want to on there.
Mm-hmm.
But amateur radio is kind of self-policing. You can't conduct business on amateur radio. Anyway, it's open to experimenting and a lot of different technologies.
Yeah. CB, you buy the gear. You can't build your own radios.
Yeah.
You can't use an amplifier, although some do.
Yeah, it's not legal, though.
It's not legal. Then you're limited to, I think, what it's like, four watts.
4 watts on AM. Maybe FM too now. I think they got FM CBs.
They do.
And 12 watts PEP on single sideband.
Yeah. And there's still a lot of people on CB. Every now and then I'll tune just down around 10 meters on my amateur radio into the 11 meter band there. And I'll hear some people there. It's quite different than listening to amateur radio.
It's to me, it's not a pleasant experience.
But a lot of people enjoy it. And,
some do.
It's there. It's
but
there.
I don't. The only thing is, like, if you travel, you listen to the trucks and stuff, you may hear some interesting stuff. So you may hear some stuff you don't want your children to hear either. So keep that in mind.
Yeah. So amateur radio, you got to take a test. There's an entry level. So you got to meet at least minimum qualifications to get in. You got to know the rules. You know, you got to basically learn some operating procedures and such. And you can get a technician class license. That's going to give you more than just that one band at 27 megahertz.
A little bit of electronics theory. Very, very little.
Yep. Yeah, a minor amount. But enough to kind of get your appetite whetted.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
But more bands you can operate on with amateur radio, more power, up to 1,500 watts. So that's...
Yeah, a lot of modes.
Yeah.
Digital stuff nowadays. All kind of cool stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Really a great time to be a ham.
A lot of different things you can do. Now, there are other radio services that you could become a member of. There's FRS, that's Family Radio Service, and that... What is that?
It's basically when you go to Walmart and you see those little walkie-talkies that say you can talk 3-4 miles with them.
Yeah.
You can't.
No.
But those are FRS. They're just for people to send off with their kids or whatever. And when you go camping with your kids, you can just communicate with them.
That's another radio service. It's a much lower power, but it does give you two-way communications.
Mm-hmm.
There's also GMRS.
Yeah, it's close to FRS.
It is.
So I think they may share some frequencies.
Yeah, they do. They share the same frequencies.
But then there's some additional ones.
Yeah, you can run a little higher power there.
Right.
And you can have repeaters there. But you have to get a license. Now, you don't have to take a test, but I think you pay a fee to get a license.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to go through the process of that on an amateur logic at some point.
Yeah.
It's on my list of things to do, so.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Email and his friends down in Slidell are big into GMRS.
Yeah, they've got repeaters to extend your coverage, which that's another thing for plus for ham radio and for a technician class, yeah. Even. Got 2 meter and 70 centimeter. There's others too, but those are the most common repeaters that you can use a walkie-talkie and talk, you know, 30, 50 miles, depending on your location, to the repeater.
Yeah. Jeff,
cool stuff.
In the chat room says FRS is 467 megahertz. Now that I think about it, that's right.
Yeah, it is. I was thinking about that too. And when we said that they shared frequencies, I remembered because so the GMRS stuff is definitely in UHF. So that's right.
Over in England, Terry says they have PMR, which is 446 megahertz.
But if you want to be one of the cool kids, get your ham ticket.
Get your ham ticket. You know, you might not be a young person, or you might. A lot of people getting licensed are people who have known about ham radio for years, but have never taken the step to get licensed.
Yeah.
And
some people, a little snow on the roof or snow on the driveway like me.
Is that what that is? Yeah.
Snow in the yard.
So we're going to study the technician exam. Now, we're already licensed. We've taken all our exams. But it's still good to review this stuff, even though we're hams. And, you know, I see a lot of people in the chat room there that are hams. Probably most of the people over in there are. They're here to have fun, too.
Yeah. Share this with your non-ham friends.
Exactly. We encourage it. So we've told you what is ham radio, but, you know, if I think back, way back into the future.
Yeah?
Wait a minute. That's a movie. Way back into the past, about 10 years ago, we talked about what is ham radio.
Yeah, we did.
And since we've already done it once, and it struck a chord with me, according to the ARL, amateur radio, or ham radio, is a popular hobby and service in which licensed amateur radio operators, or hams, operate communications equipment. And although amateur radio operators get involved for a lot of different reasons, you know, we've all got a lot of things in common, basic knowledge of radio technology, operating principles, you know, we had to pass an exam to get a license to operate on the radio frequencies known as amateur bands. So we've all got that kind of stuff in common. And, you know, these bands of frequencies are reserved for use by licensed amateurs like you and me and a lot of you watching out there by the different governments in the world. And there are agreements, you know, as to who can use what frequencies in which areas of the world. And in the United States, it's the Federal Communications Commission that issues amateur radio licenses.
Right.
So why don't you ask me a question, Tommy?
Okay. Why do they call it ham?
That is a good question. And, you know, one time I thought it, and I don't know where I heard it, I thought it meant home amateur. But nah,
no,
that's not what it means at all.
Well, what does it mean?
Well, you may be surprised.
Well, I already am.
Yeah, I surprise you anyway, even if you aren't. A ham is, according to this, he's a poor operator, a plug. And this came from Granville Mellon Dodge, the telegraph instructor. You know, this guy was around back during the time of the Civil War, and apparently he was a telegraph instructor, too. I know he was big in communications. He coined the term ham, and that was just strictly talking about telegraph operators. The first wireless operators were landline telegraphers who left that field and their offices to go to sea or to man coastal stations, because, you know, early radio communications got started with ship-to-shore stuff. You know, that was really probably the most important area that was going to benefit immediately from radio communications. And, of course, they had to use Morse code. And so they took all these telegraph operators and put them on ships. And they brought with them, you know, a lot of their language and their traditions from their older profession. And in those early days, every station was using spark gap transmitters because we didn't really have modern electronic circuitry at that time. It's basically you just take a bunch of power and you make it arc, and somebody can hear that.
It's going to disturb everything.
Yeah, just like that insulator out there on the electric pole.
Yeah.
When it acts up. So by using those spark generators, one guy talking to another guy across town could wipe out the whole band. I mean, not just the narrow frequency, because there weren't any such thing. It was just everything.
Right.
If you had enough power. And so a lot of the government ships and coastal stations, you know, they were talking about these amateur guys at home who were, you know, getting in to radio at the same time, just taking over completely their airwaves with their powerful stations. And so the frustrated commercial operators would refer to the ham radio interference by calling the amateur operators hams.
Ah.
A term that had come from telegraph.
Okay.
And, you know, amateurs, probably unfamiliar with the real meaning of the term, just picked it up and ran with it.
Yeah.
You know, sounds good to us.
It sounds great. I love ham.
So, you know, as the years have gone on, the original meaning has completely disappeared, but that's kind of how it got started.
Well, that's interesting to know. I really didn't know that.
I didn't think you did. And you looked really surprised, even if you were faking it.
But, yeah. Pretty good acting, huh?
Yeah. Was
actually I didn't know it.
If you're going to be studying for your technician exam, you can watch these episodes and go take the exam. You can download the question pool off the internet and go take your exam. But there's a couple of resources that we recommend for books. One is Gordon West Technician Class Exam Book. The ARRL also has technician books.
Well, actually, the ARRL is the publisher for Gordo now. So.
The ARRL Ham Radio License Manual. Now, this is wire-bound here. There's a good deal of information about ham radio and some of the different topics that'll be on the exam. So that's another good resource right there.
It's always good to know more than just the bare minimum, just to answer.
Did you say no Morse?
Morris? No, I said no more.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you.
No more than just a basic answer.
I misunderstood you there. I thought you wanted to tell us a little more about Morse code.
Yeah, I might.
Well, let's see. It seems to me like we talked about that one time.
Let me remember back. So I think everybody knows that Samuel Morse invented Morse code. Samuel Morse was born in Charlestown, Massachusetts on April 27, 1791. He attended Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, but eventually went on to attend Yale College to study a variety of subjects from religious philosophy, mathematics, and the science of horses. Morse was also a painter. He used that skill to support himself. Morse graduated from Yale with honors. In 1825, New York City hired Morse to paint a portrait of Lafayette. While he was painting, a horse messenger delivered a letter from his father saying that his wife was very sick. The next day, he received a letter from his father telling that his wife had passed away. Morse immediately left for his home in New Haven without finishing the portrait of Lafayette. By the time he made it home, his wife had already been buried. Heartbroken because he was unaware of his wife's illness, then death, he decided to try and find a way to send messages long distances quickly. Morse code was born. Morse code's a method of transmitting text information as a series of on-off tones, lights, or clicks that can be directly understood by a skilled listener or observer without special equipment. An electrical telegraph was independently developed and patented in the United States in 1837 by Samuel Morse. His assistant, Alfred Vail, developed the Morse code signaling alphabet with Morse. The first telegram in the United States was sent by Morse on the 11th of January, 1838, across 2 miles of wire at Speedwell Ironworks near Morristown, New Jersey. although it was only later in 1844 that he sent the message, "What hath God wrought," from Capitol Hill in Washington to the old Mount Clair Depot in Baltimore. The Morse Vale Telegraph was quickly deployed in the following two decades. Morse code is most popular among amateur radio operators, although it's no longer required for licensing in most countries.
Good communication's come a long ways. The poor man found out about his wife being sick, and then she was gone by the time he got back.
You know, the technology back then was pretty primitive.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take a whole lot to be able to send Morse code. Just you had to agree on here's what the code means, the dots and dashes. Why don't we build something like that?
Okay, let's do that.
Oh, boy, we just happen to have some parts here, don't
we? Yeah, hey,
we're going to need some tools.
Yeah, I found a screwdriver.
Yeah, me too.
What about this cover for an expansion card for a computer?
Yeah, back of a computer, I'm sure that's probably what they use.
Here's a couple of pieces of wood that they're kind of stuck together. We'll just use them like that.
L-shaped, yeah. I've got some screws here.
What about a little wire?
That wire I wound up on a nail to keep it handy?
Yeah, that makes a good place to keep your wire.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I'm just going to kind of stick it in this hole right here for right now.
Yeah, why don't you do that? All right, so you're sticking the nail in the wood.
Yep, put the nail in the wood. I've got to have it someplace.
And that's just a bunch of wire just kind of coiled up on a nail and the two ends of the wire hanging free here.
Right. And we're going to need the key.
That's going to be the noisemaker.
So let's go ahead and tighten that down.
And they didn't have electric screwdrivers in those days, so that's why we're not using one.
That's why we went primitive with it.
Yeah. Needs to be almost... That might work.
Okay.
So that's the receiver.
Right.
Well, I'm going to build the transmitter then.
All right.
All right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my piece of wood and one of these covers off the back plane of a computer here. And I'm going to just screw it down to the wood. I've got a piece of wire here.
Is this how Vibroplex got started?
You know, it could be. I'm not sure. They may have been around before computers, so they had to get their metal from somewhere else. I'm just going to take a screw, and I'm going to stick the wire down in a hole here. Let me see if you can see that. There's a hole in the wood. I'm just going to stick the wire down in there, and I'm going to tighten up a screw over it. And then I'm going to take this piece of metal and just screw it there and leave a little gap in there. This is essentially a switch. You know, when you push down on it, it makes contact and the electricity can get on through. And Tommy, you've got a wire over there with nothing on it on your receiver, don't you? You got a wire you're not doing anything with.
I got one here that doesn't have anything on it. You want to borrow this one?
Yeah, let me borrow that one. If you would, just slip it under the corner of that metal there. Maybe I need to loosen up the metal a little, huh?
There you go.
All right.
Maybe that'll hold it good and snug till I figure out what I want to do with
it. There you go. I'm not hearing anything over there.
No? But we got some other wires here. Maybe we ought to do something with that.
Well, I just happen to have this old 12-volt, 7.5 ampere-hour battery.
Yeah, that's from a game feeder from back in the 1780s.
Yeah, I think this thing was actually used to make arcs on a file. It's an inside joke, but it actually was. Yeah.
Okay, so you want to put this one on the positive?
Yeah, it doesn't matter where you put it.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to get kind of back here out of the way.
Knocked our transmitter or our receiver over.
You know, this wire I've got just happened to have one of these clips on the end of it here, too. So I'm going to hook it to the other terminal of the battery. And now, before we go any further, let me just say, you probably shouldn't be doing this with a 12-volt, 7.5 ampere-hour battery.
Yeah.
He's probably be using maybe a 6-volt lantern battery or something like that, because this can get hot.
Right. So,
well, let's see. If I push it down and close the circuit here, let's see if anything happens over on your side, Tommy.
Hey. Hold on a minute. My receiver's receiving.
I'm going to send you a call here. This was actually should have been sent before the show started today.
Yeah. Your transmitter's making fire. Don't get any paper near it.
I could use this for an arc gap too, couldn't
yeah.
I? A spark gap. Now, with this big battery here, this metal gets a little warm here. You don't want to hold down on this.
No.
But you can see it works there pretty good.
Yeah, this battery's really got too much current, but this is the only one we had. So
Yeah. So there you go. There's our homemade telegraph station. We can use it for long distance communications, like 3 feet
yeah,
here.
Across the table. Yeah.
Yeah. And if one of us really knew code, we could send Morse code back and forth. I sent SOS a while ago, but probably a pretty poor SOS. I would have been called a ham.
Yeah. So they actually used one wire transmitters.
They did?
One wire telegraph.
All right. So how did they complete the circuit?
I don't know, but that's what it said. It said one wire.
It must have been that the other post of the battery must have gone to ground. That would have been the only way I could think of it. A neat little project. I built one of these when I was a kid, and I thought it would be something interested for new hams to look at. And, you know, very simple. You could make this wire much longer. And
oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot longer. And when I was a kid, I used to be fascinated by electromagnets, which that's mm-hmm. what the whole thing works off the principle of. But I used to make those all the time, laying around.
You know, I think I want to hang on to these parts here because there's probably some experiments we can do in the future that we can use some of this stuff for right here.
Yeah, and if it gets cold in here this winter, you can just hit that key a few times.
Yeah, I'll have to warm up my finger.
You know, got you a little heater.
Yeah. Okay, so there you go, a homemade telegraph key and... I think you call it sender and receiver, but I'm not sure about that. So maybe somebody will straighten us out on that.
Yep.
We probably should move this off the table now and get on to the next part of the show. In the early days, what a ham radio set might have looked like right here. This one was built by Ralph Boucher in Toledo, Iowa in the early 1900s. That was a kilowatt station, I believe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Pretty cryptic stuff back then, and all of it was home-built, like a lot of it is today.
Yeah, and large. It's pretty big.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of space.
And we actually did do a future project with that.
Yeah, because it doesn't look exactly the same.
No, it's got a modification to it. We'll be looking at that in the future. Plus, I think we may do another modification to it. I've got one in mind. I'm just not sure it'll work.
It's already a heater. Maybe we can reverse it and make it to a cooler. It's pretty warm in here.
That's an idea. If you want to become a ham, you're going to have to take a test. Now, yeah. We probably need to know a little more about the regulatory situation here.
Yeah.
Who regulates ham radio?
Well, that would be the FCC, or the Federal Communications Commission. They regulate interstate and international communications by radio, television, wire, satellite and cable in all 50 states, the District of Columbia, and U.S. territories. An independent U.S. government agency overseen by Congress, the Commission is the United States' primary authority for communications law, regulation, and technological innovation. The FCC's rules and regulations are in Title 47 of the Code of Federal Regulations, or CFR, which are published and maintained by the Government Printing Office. Title 47 rules and regulations are also available on the web in searchable format.
It's not just the FCC alone. There's amateur radio all over the world, and there's all these different governmental agencies regulating it in each country. I think in Canada, it is Industry Canada.
Is it?
I believe it is.
Hmm.
I believe that's
interesting.
Who regulates it in Canada.
To me, it's a good thing to have. I mean, I'm glad we have them because otherwise it'd just be like the Wild West out there.
Yeah. Over in the UK, I'm waiting. Hopefully, Terry will tell us who regulates it in the UK, and I should know the answer to that.
They just had a change. I read about that on Amateur Logic. Changed their license and they got more privileges, more power.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the organization, though.
Ofcom.
Yeah, that's it. Thanks, Terry.
Yeah. And I don't know, is that Office of Communications, maybe?
Yeah, I believe it is.
ARRL is the National Association for Amateur Radio in the U.S., founded in 1914 by Hiram Percy Maximum as the American Radio Relay League. The ARRL is a non-commercial organization for radio amateurs. ARRL's underpinnings as the amateur radio's witness, partner, and forum are defined by five pillars: public service, advocacy, education, technology, and membership. A bona fide interest in amateur radio is the only essential qualification of membership. An amateur radio license is not a prerequisite, although full voting membership is only granted to licensed radio amateurs in the U.S.
They're a necessary thing, too, in my opinion. Without them, they're the ones that keep from taking some of our bands, our privileges, and things like that, selling them off.
Yeah.
They're kind of our advocate for that and yep. other things. So they're a good things. Organization.
And always...
I'm a member. I resisted it for a long time, but kind of saw the light. It's a good thing to be part of.
Yep, I am too. You know, I mentioned the guy who founded that back in 1914.
Yeah?
Hiram Percy Maximum. He's an engineer, a scientist, an inventor, and a hobbyist. He earned patents for his inventions in automotive design, noise abatement, and other fields.
Cool.
Also a passionate hobbyist, he left his mark on early aviation and wireless radio. Maximum's broadly recognized achievements brought fame to Hartford, where he made his home from 1899 until his death in 1936. And here's something I didn't know, and I bet you didn't know it. I'm not sure if anyone watching realized this. As the automobile evolved in the early 20th century, inventors in the United States looked toward battery-driven vehicles as the future of transportation. Seems familiar.
He's the Elon Musk of yesteryear.
He's not. A number of small firms throughout New England produced these early electric power vehicles. Among them was Albert Pope's Columbia Automotive Company of Hartford. Maxim, however, found the idea of gasoline-powered engines intriguing, and in 1899, the Columbia Automotive Company adopted his pioneering concept, which evolved from an engine-driven bicycle to an engine-driven four-wheel vehicle. Maxim's design would become the Columbia gasoline carriage. The vehicle was one of the first of its kind manufactured in the world. And I bet you didn't know that.
I did not know that. That's pretty cool. And I'm glad to know that a ham was kind of the anti-electric vehicle. Because I don't know if I'd go that I'm anti-electric vehicle. But I just don't think we're quite ready for that yet. I don't think it's quite ready for us yet.
Yeah, I don't think it's ready for prime time. Although,
it's
you know.
It's an interesting concept.
Yeah, if you live where you're not going to be driving very far, and you're not worried about your vehicle bursting into flames. Well, that can happen with gasoline, too.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, there's it's just not ready for us down here.
Yeah, but the emissions thing is, I think that's really the only huge benefit of it, because it's not costing you less. Because if you're not buying, you're not paying for gas, you're paying for batteries and electric charge it, stuff like mm-hmm. that. And it's not that much cheaper. So I think in the long run, they end up costing more, but.
Yeah.
Moving right along.
You know, Maxim introduced the gasoline engine. Those early vehicles were really noisy.
Mm-hmm.
He invented the muffler.
No way.
Yeah, he did. And he also invented a number of other noise abatement solutions for different types of things. The aviation aspect, I didn't even look into that, but man, that guy had some hobbies.
Yeah. Sounded like a pretty busy fellow.
He was.
I've drilled holes in the back of some of his inventions before when I was in young guy.
Oh, I did on my motorcycle. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think he invented the glass pack, but I'm not sure on that one. Where are we going from here? Well, we've talked about the FCC. We've talked about the ARRL. There's another organization you might want to know about because they're the ones who are going to give you the exam.
The NCVEC, the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, is a not-for-profit voluntary association with membership comprised of various Federal Communications Commission Certified Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, or VECs. The NCVEC is a private organization, functions to facilitate the intercommunications between the FCC and each VEC. Each active VEC is invited to join the NCVEC and actively participate. The NCVEC holds an annual conference, usually near the end of July. The NCVEC is governed by a body of elected officers, consisting of a chairman, vice chairman, secretary, and a treasurer. And that was quite the mouthful.
Yeah. While you were saying that, I hung this piece of paper on my shirt here.
Yeah.
I think you've got one, too.
I do have one. Mine's expired. I didn't realize it expired a few months ago.
Yeah.
I've actually emailed about redoing mine while I was sitting here tonight.
So. Yeah. Mine's good for another, 2 years and 3 months, I think.
Yeah, I thought I had a reminder in my phone to remind me about that, but apparently I didn't.
This is my extra class accredited volunteer examiner badge. We are accredited VEs. We work with the VEC, and we don't head up the testing in this area. We're just volunteers, and occasionally we will go participate in some exam sessions. I didn't do it this year, but usually I participate in the one at the local ham fest. We do things like hand out the exam sheets or hand out pencils, grade the exams, whatever they need us to do. And there's a number of different organizations besides just the ARRL. That's who we're accredited with.
Yeah, these expire after 10 years.
There's a number of different organizations, or actually VECs out there, more than just ARRL. There's a good many of them.
Yeah, quite a few.
Anchorage, Central Alabama, I never knew.
Oh, Golden Empire Amateur Radio Society, yeah. Greater LA.
Jefferson Amateur Radio Club. There's a good many of them there. W5YI VEC is another big one.
Yeah.
So if you want to take your exam, go to the ARRL.org website. There you can actually find listings of when exams are going to be given and what areas.
There's actually some online stuff you can do nowadays, too.
Thanks to the pandemic we just went through, one good thing that came out of it, and probably the only good thing
one
that came
I can
out
think
of it, is now they can give the exams online. So you can, if you can't find someone giving the exam in your area, you can find an online examiner who will give you the test. Particularly if you're an extra class or a general class, why don't you get you one of these and help out, make some new hams? It doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to take an exam. Basically, you just go online, answer some questions, fill out a form.
It's a little open book thing, but it's super easy.
I mean, oh, yeah.
You got it right there.
Yeah,
you can't miss it. You can't, not pass it.
Right. So, somebody did it for you, and that's all I got to say about that right now. Well, I say that is, however, it could come up in some of these questions. What do you say we go over a few of these questions?
Okay.
Now, first, this is broken up into different sections. The one we're going to talk about tonight is the purpose and permissible use of the amateur radio service, operator/primary station license grants, meaning of basic terms used in FCC rules, interference, RACES rules, phonetics, and frequency coordination.
Hmm.
That's a good bit of stuff. So nice. The first question, why don't you ask me?
Okay. I think I will. How about this one? Which of the following is part of the basis and purpose of the amateur radio service? A, providing personal radio communications for as many citizens as possible.
B, providing communications for international nonprofit organizations.
Or C, advancing skills in the technical and communications phases of the radio art.
Or D, all of these choices are correct. Which of the following is part of the basis and purpose of amateur radio service? Let's see, providing personal radio communications for as many citizens as possible. No, it is not A, so it can't be D. So let's look at B, providing communications for international nonprofit organizations. Nah. C, advancing skills in the technical and communication phases of the radio art. That's my answer right there. I'm going to say it's C. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I like that, the radio art.
Yep.
Let's go with that.
Okay. We have a little radio art right here behind us, as a matter of fact.
We actually do.
Yeah. Chat room. Oh, they're saying C. That makes sense.
It is art. It's a beautiful thing.
It is.
Cool.
Which agency, I think you may know the answer to this.
I think we may have read this one.
Which agency regulates and enforces the rules for the amateur radio service in the United States? A, FEMA.
B, Homeland Security.
C, the FCC.
Or D, all these choices are correct. Well, since I just read that blurb, and I just so happen to kind of know this one, I know it's not FEMA. That's Federal Emergency Management Association, I think.
Agency,
some similar thing. It's not Homeland Security, and it's not all these are correct. It's the FCC or the Federal Communications Commission. C.
Oh, you just knocked it right out of the park.
And that's my final answer.
That's what everyone in the chat room is saying. Fist bump to all of you.
Well, since most of those guys have call signs on their names, I'm pretty sure.
They do. They should know this stuff.
They do so far.
Yep. Another question.
What do the FCC rules state regarding the use of a phonetic alphabet for station identification in the amateur radio service? A, it's required when transmitting emergency messages.
B, it is encouraged.
C, it is required when in contact with foreign stations.
Or D, all these choices are correct. What do the FCC rules state regarding the use of phonetic alphabet for station identification in the amateur radio service? It's not required when transmitting emergency messages. C, it's required when in contact with foreign stations. No. So it's not D. So B, it's encouraged. And that wouldn't...
Yeah, that's what I think,
I
too.
Wouldn't have... That's not where I would have gone, but that's the only one that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And it's a good idea to do it. I'm sure we'll get into the phonetic stuff at a later date. But
yeah. Chat room's a little mixed on this. So, let's see.
Encouraged.
It's encouraged. What do you say we take a quick break, come back, and we'll go over some more of these?
Okay.
Keep your contesting edge and be a Field Day leader with ICOM. Field Day is one of amateur radio's favorite events and is just around the corner. On June 22nd and 23rd, more than 40,000 North American hams will come together to operate remotely. ICOM's robust and high-quality transceivers easily cut through polyps so you can work the bands and make those contacts. ICOM is the clear choice for DXers and contesters around the globe. Upgrade your station with one of ICOM's fabulous HF radios. With the IC7610, faint signals are no longer challenging for DXers and contesters. The high-performance RMDR can pick out the faintest of signals, even in the presence of stronger adjacent signals. This is the SDR every ham wants. With ICOM's IC905, VHF contesting is a breeze. This all-mode rig covers five bands with one radio. 2 meters, 70 centimeters, 1.2 gigahertz, 2.4 gigahertz, 5.6 gigahertz bands, and with the optional CX10G transverter, 10 gigahertz. Large color touchscreen, easy D-Star settings, and a separate controller and RF module configuration to reduce signal loss. Explore the world of microwave with the IC905. The IC705 and IC7300 are the perfect go-to rigs for outdoor hams who love POTA and SOTA activations. Both radios feature a large touchscreen with real-time spectrum scope and waterfall for intuitive function and setting operations. The IC705 provides base station features and performance in the palm of your hand from HF to 50, 144, and 440 MHz. The IC7300 is an industry first, using RF direct sampling in an entry-level HF radio. For those of you with an IC7610 or IC7300, head on over to ICOMAmerica.com and download the latest firmware to get ICOM's new digital pre-distortion capabilities. This technology corrects nonlinear distortion at the final amplifier stage by applying inverse distortion at the pre-distortion section in the FPGA unit in advance. If you're getting a head start on hurricane season, ICOM's IC7100, ID5100, ID50, or ID52 are the perfect traveling companions and should be on your go-kit list. From high-powered base stations to compact and travel-friendly handhelds, ICOM radios offer in-demand features and functions to keep you active on all bands, inside your shack, or out in the field. For more information about ICOM's amateur radios, visit ICOMAmerica.com/amateur today.
Well, since you're not going to sing one for us, why don't you give away a shirt?
Okay. Actually, I got a great shirt here. Who are we going to give it to?
Well, I think the way we will give it away is we'll do a drawing.
Well, this is what you're going to draw for, a nice ICOM Ham Crew t-shirt. Compliments to ICOM. You look just as good when you get to the Ham Fest. Well, it looks just as good leaving the Ham Fest as you do when you showed up.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's a really nice shirt. It's a good heavy t-shirt. I like it. I wear mine fairly often.
So if somebody wanted to win that, all you got to do is send an email to hamcollege@amateurlogic.tv. You don't have to be a ham. You really don't have to have anything but a name and an email address so that you can send an email. hamcollege@amateurlogic.tv. If you'd like to put a little message in there to us, we always appreciate those. And usually people are sending, if they send anything at all, they're sending one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, right before the show tonight, did a random drawing of the entries we received. And we got a winner right here, and he actually had a message.
Did he? Okay, cool.
Yep. He said, "Hi, guys. Please enter me for a chance to win a free t-shirt. Thanks, 73. Mike, NY1U.
Well, cool. Congratulations, Mike.
And I noticed on the from line in the email here, it said Mike Dipoles.
Mike dot what?
Mike Dipoles.
Oh.
But it's really Mike Grimaldi.
Cool. Well, congratulations, Mike. Jesse from ICOM will be getting in touch with you soon to get your information to send it to you. Now, what happens next with the email queue, George?
The emails, they all have been deleted. Whenever we draw a winner, we clear out the poll. There's none left.
You mean we don't keep them?
We don't keep them, so people have to re-enter every month, and it doesn't cost you anything. It's an email. You don't even have to put a stamp on it.
That's the best kind of mail.
Yep.
Free.
So send us one, hamcollege@amateurlogic.tv. Maybe you'll be the best dressed ham at the next Ham Fest.
Or on the way out.
Or on the way to take your exam.
That's better.
How many operator/primary station license grants may be held by any one person? A, 1.
B, no more than 2.
C, 1 for each band on which the person plans to operate.
Or D, 1 for each permanent station location from which the person plans to operate. Well, you don't get one for each permanent station, a separate one. So it's not D, 1 for each band. You don't have a different license for each band. B, no more than 2. As far as I know, you can only have 1, so it's got to be A, 1.
However, there are 2 licenses with my name on it.
Ham licenses?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's not a primary station license, though.
No. I'm W5JDX. But you can get a club license if you've got a club. And we do. It's a Southern Amateur Radio
Experimenters
Club. W5 Alpha X-Ray Charlie. AXC. And we'll be using that call next weekend on field day. So look for us on the air, W5AXC.
Yeah, we'll be the loud ones you hear on all the bands.
We'll be the tiny little voice you hear coming up under all the big stations, trying to make a few contacts. So if you hear us, give us a shout.
Don't want to drown in the noise.
we're going to try to increase our number of points this year.
You're trying something new.
Trying something new. And we'll be talking about that after the event. Yeah, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't. What proves that the FCC has issued an operator/primary license grant? A, a printed copy of the certificate of successful completion of examination.
B, an email notification from the NCVEC granting the license.
C, the license appears in the FCC ULS database.
Or D, all these choices are correct.
What proves that the FCC has issued me a license? C, the license appears in the FCC Universal Licensing System database.
Yep. When you take your test and you pass, as soon as your license appears in that FCC database, you can get on there and use it.
Yep.
Well, it's, you don't actually get it mailed to you anymore, so you can print it that time, too. So.
Yeah. But once you get that, you'll get your call sign. And we're talking about technicians. You don't have a call sign before this, so you'll be issued one then. Unlike it was back in 1991 when I got licensed, I went and took my exam, and it was a month I had to wait before the license finally showed up in the mail and I could get on the air.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it used to take some time, but it's. Yeah. I think that's my understanding that it's pretty quick nowadays.
Yeah, it's.
I think all the VECs send it in electronic now, I'm pretty sure.
Usually, I mean, you might get it the next day. It might be 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be a month.
It won't be a month.
Shouldn't even be weeks, really.
No, I don't think it'll be weeks unless they had a problem. You know, the folks giving the exam for one reason or another didn't get everything submitted before that. So now I got one for you.
Okay, hit me now.
What is the FCC Part 97 definition of a beacon? A government transmitter marking the amateur radio band edges.
B, a bulletin sent by the FCC to announce a national emergency.
C, a continuous transmission of weather information authorized in the amateur bands by the National Weather Service.
Or D, an amateur station transmitting communications for the purpose of observing propagation or related experimental activities. What is FCC Part 97 definition of a beacon? It's not a government things marking their band edges. You know, that's all published. You should know where your bands are. You can get actually download a band chart. B, a bulletin sent by the FCC. It's not a bulletin. Continuous transmission of weather information. Information authorized amateur bands. Nope. D, an amateur station transmitting communications for the purpose of observing propagation or related experimental activities. Peter actually did a nice segment a long time ago in Amateur Logic about amateur radio beacons. I think that was Peter.
That was Jimmy.
Oh, was it?
I think it was Jimmy.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I'm going with D.
I'm going to agree with you. Marty agrees with you. And it is. He said he was thinking ahead a while ago.
Yeah, it's premonition.
Yeah, okay.
That's a pretty good deal, Marty.
The beacon is just a station that's sitting there, just transmits its call sign every so often, and maybe its location, and that's it. It doesn't listen for anybody to respond. It's just a way to check propagation. Let's say there's a beacon in California, maybe 20 meters. I can listen on my radio, and let's say I turn it on right now. I don't hear anything on the frequency that beacon's on.
Mm-hmm.
But if I turn it on during the day tomorrow, I might hear that beacon, and then I'll know that the propagation is open to there. So that'd be a good reason
to
have a beacon.
Yep. All right, here we go. I'm going to hit you with a hard one here. Don't space out on me. What's the FCC Part 97 definition of a space station? A, any satellite orbiting Earth.
B, a manned satellite orbiting Earth.
C, an amateur station located more than 50 kilometers above Earth's surface.
D, an amateur station using amateur radio satellites for relay of signals. What is the FCC Part 97 definition of a space station? A, any satellite orbiting the Earth. D, an amateur station using amateur radio satellites for relay of signals. Because that could indicate any amateur station, you know, on the ground here, relaying satellite signals. C, an amateur station located more than 50 kilometers above Earth's surface. That's a possibility. B, a manned satellite orbiting Earth. Now, because we have satellites, are things that would be considered a space station that don't have anybody on them for amateur radio purposes. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say it's C.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Marty says it's D. Let's see. It is. You know, you would think almost that when they get started putting numbers in there like that, that's not a good answer. But I'm going to say all the other answers were not the right answers, so this was all that was left.
That's good. Good deduction. Yeah.
The 50 kilometers, that's not just the thing that would come to top of mind for me, but that is the answer for it. Oh, we're 50 gonna,
kilometers. What is that, like 30 miles?
Man, I'm not Canadian. I can't answer that. What's it in Kelvin?
Good question. Mike's not in there to tell us.
Which of the following entities recommends transmit-receive channels and other parameters for auxiliary and repeater stations? A, frequency spectrum manager appointed by the FCC.
B, volunteer frequency coordinator recognized by local amateurs.
C, FCC regional field office.
Or D, International Telecommunication Union. Which of the following entities recommends transmit-receive channels and other parameters for auxiliary and repeater stations? Frequency spectrum manager. I don't even know what the frequency spectrum manager is, so I'm thinking that's not it. B, volunteer frequency coordinator. I'm thinking that's the answer, but let's look at the other ones. C, FCC regional field office. They don't do it. They don't want you to violate what's recommended, but they don't do that. D, International Telecommunications Union. No, I'm going with B. volunteer frequency coordinator recognized by local amateurs.
I'm going to agree with you. It's B. Marty's agreeing it's B. And it is.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Mississippi and several other states in the South here, it's SERA, S-E-R-A.
Southeast Repeater Association.
Yep. They're the ones who coordinate frequencies for our repeaters and auxiliary stations around here. Now, different parts of the country, it's different. Those guys are volunteers. They are, they're not appointed by the FCC. But it's an agreement that all the hams agree in this area that these people are going to coordinate our frequencies. That way, it's not everybody for himself just jumping on a frequency and
right
and sticking repeaters on it. And
yeah, and it's a very necessary thing too.
Oh, yeah.
Because you don't want that interference.
No,
people kind of stepping on one another with it. Yeah, they do a good job. We actually know one of the guys that's one of the ones here.
We actually have a repeater coordinated with them, and you know we'll say we'd like to use this frequency. They'll research it and say, no, there's somebody that's X number of miles away, and y'all would interfere with each other. Maybe you go to this frequency. Well, they'll help you figure it out.
Who selects a frequency coordinator? A, the FCC Office of Spectrum Management and Coordination Policy.
B, the local chapter of the Office of National Council of Independent Frequency Coordinators.
C, amateur operators in a local or regional area whose stations are eligible to be repeater or auxiliary stations.
Or D, the FCC Regional Field Office. Well, I think I just answered this one before the question came up.
Yeah, I think you did.
It's not the FCC.
You going to go with D?
I'm going to, no. It's not A or D because it's not the FCC. You know, they kind of want us to be self-regulating and... I was going to say something ugly, but they're a government organization, you know. They don't want to do any more than they got to do because they got other stuff going on besides amateur radio. They kind of want us to take care of ourselves as much as possible, be self-policing. The local chapter of the Office of National Council of Independent Frequency Coordinators, I don't think there's such a thing. It's the amateur operators in local or regional areas whose stations are eligible to be repeater or auxiliary stations. Marty says it's C. So
yeah, if you think about it, that's interesting. That's good. I mean, the people that are got repeaters, you want them to pick somebody that they trust to do a good job.
Yeah. On it. Or the people who are eligible to have repeaters or auxiliary stations, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, RACES? A, a radio service using amateur frequencies for emergency management or civil defense communications.
B, a radio service using amateur stations for emergency management or civil defense communications.
C, an emergency service using amateur operators certified by a civil defense organization as being enrolled in that organization.
Or D, all these choices are correct. I'm going to have to read this again. I'm glad
you got it.
Yeah, I'm not too much sure about this. I'm going to have to think about this one. What is the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, RACES? The service. A radio service using amateur frequencies for emergency management or civil defense communication. I think it's B. I'm not 100% sure on this one, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I wanted to say D, but I don't think that's quite right.
Well,
I think it's,
let's see.
It is D. Marty, I should have took your answer.
No, Marty said C this time.
He said D before.
Yeah.
He was getting ready for this one.
Yeah. Tom said he thought it was D, and now he's sticking with it. Good choice, Tom. I was going to say C.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's right.
Well.
So is
yeah,
mine.
But it's not the only thing that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, Marty, I would have been right there with you. I would have said C on that. Fortunately, Tommy took the buzzer for us.
You're welcome.
Yep.
When is willful interference to other amateur radio stations permitted? A, to stop another amateur station that is breaking the FCC rules.
That's just what you want. B, at no time.
C, when making short test transmissions.
Or D, at any time. Stations in the amateur radio service are not protected from willful interference. When is willful interference to other amateur radio stations permitted? D, at any time stations in amateur radio service are not protected from willful interference? No. That's right, D. Well, we're not protected from it, but
you're expected not make, to do
that
it.
That doesn't make it right.
No.
C, when making short test transmissions. No. A, to stop another amateur station that is breaking the FCC rules. That's just what we need is band police.
Yeah,
or repeater
a key
police.
Down contest.
Yeah, that's not it.
Nope.
It's B, at no time. We're never allowed to willfully interfere with other amateur radio stations. That's my answer.
Nope.
B,
and it doesn't
no
happen very often. I don't know that I've heard it except on maybe one frequency that.
Oh, I've heard it.
You.
Yeah, if you tune around enough, you'll.
I've heard it on 14313 before.
Yeah, you can hear it on. You can hear it a lot of places. I've heard it on repeaters.
Yeah.
It's
not that common. It's pretty common on CB
well,
though.
Yeah. It can be common on HF. It's not really common at all on VHF or UHF mm-hmm. around here, but in some larger cities it could be, but it's wrong. And that's it. That's all the questions in this
already?
Portion. Yes.
I was just kind of getting warmed up.
Well.
I only got one buzzer tonight.
That's okay. We can pull down the Morse code key there and you can warm
it's your finger. It's too hot to use that thing tonight. We need to wait for cooler weather to start yeah. that thing up.
So, you might want to join Ham College High Society, facebook.com/groups/Ham College.
High Society. You can follow us on at Ham College on Twitter or X.
Or you can subscribe to our groups.io/g/amateurlogic group. And there we'll send out messages in advance of when there's going to be a live stream coming up or when a episode has been posted, and that's about all that gets sent on there. So if you subscribe to the groups.io feed, that's all you're going to really get.
We also have a Twitter account at Amateur Logic Twitter account.
Yeah.
I don't post on it very often. Usually if we go to a ham fest or something, I may post a few things from field day next weekend. So
yeah. And Facebook as well. /amateurlogic, and that's probably where most of our activity is, but Ham College is there as well. There is one other web location that you might want to know about, and that's amateurlogic.tv/wiki. If you go there, you can find show notes on what was covered on different episodes of Amateur Logic and Ham College. And Tommy has a bulletin for us here, a special information.
Yeah, special notice. This is actually about the Logic Net. You know, we did the Soundcheck Net for quite a while, and we kind of took a little break from that. And Tom, WA2IVD, was kind enough to pick up the net and kind of run with it and did the Logic Net. But we have a little trouble banning it and stuff. Anyway, let me read the note he sent out about it. It says, "Hello, everyone. Apologize for Mainnet no-show. Had an unexpected work schedule change while out of town. Wasn't able to coordinate the backup plan," which that happens, especially over the summer months. "LogicNet's going to take a pause for the summer. Summer's always busy with travel and outdoor activities. This will give everyone a break for a few months. There'll be no logic nets in June, July, or August. And that'll start back on Tuesday, September the 24th at 8 p.m. Central Time, 0100 UTC on September 25th. Look forward to hearing from all of you then. Have a great summer. Thank you for supporting the net. 73, Tom, WA2IVD.
We'll be back at the end of next month, so that is going to be probably around July the 26th. Probably.
Yeah, should be.
Should be. The next Amateur Logic, which is our main show. I say our main show, our flagship
show. It's our first show.
Our first show. That will be on June the 28th.
2 weeks from tonight.
2 weeks from tonight. And we'll have a wrap-up of our field day coverage and what everybody did and what worked and what didn't work that should have and what we won't try next year.
Yeah, well, we're going to try for shooting for extra points this year, so we'll see how that pans out.
Yep. We appreciate everyone being here. Tell all your friends, people that you work with that you think might want to become ham operators to check out hamcollege.tv.
It's where all the cool kids hang out.
That is. And a few nerds, too.
Well, to me, that's the cool kids.
Well, yeah. It's the most fun since the circus went bust. There you go, Tom.
There you go.
That's that ought to bring them right in. All right, 7-3.
7-3, everybody. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, some of you.